Hello, everyone. This is Senator Jacob Javits with another report to the people of New York on the situation here in Washington. Before I introduce my guest, who is a very distinguished reporter from our state, I'd like to just cover a couple of issues very briefly. First, next week I will be introducing the National Institutions Act of 1974. This is an effort to give the Congress co-equal powers in shaping the laws and policy of the country with the President of the United States. This effort was really kicked off for me by the War Powers Resolution, of which I'm one of the main authors, which for the first time in our modern history gives Congress a real grip on whether we should go to war, like the Vietnam War. And so from that base and realizing that what Watergate has opened up can only be finished by firming up the powers of Congress, I have a number of recommendations. Among them are that not only the President but the Congress should author a State of the Union message, that the Congress should have its own lawyers and not have to resort only to the Department of Justice to enforce a subpoena, that just like the Executive Department has liaison agents here in the Congress, we, each of our committees that has jurisdiction in a given area, should have liaison agents also in the various government departments. And as another point, for example, that every year we would have the right to declare ourselves satisfied or unsatisfied with the way the Executive Department is enforcing the laws, as that's the duty of the President of the United States. There are other provisions, but those are the main ones. And I hope you'll all take a very great interest in this really fundamental reform in American constitutional power. The other thing I wanted to mention was the national health insurance situation. We're all interested in that. I've had bills in for that for a long time, and the matter is now coming to a head. We may not have legislation this year, but I think we surely will next year. The two principal bills are the administration bill and a bill authored by Congressman Mills, a very powerful congressman, and Senator Kennedy of Massachusetts. It's the latter bill that I'm the most sympathetic with and will probably support with some changes. The basic difference between the two is that the Mills-Kennedy bill requires an addition to Social Security payments, in return for which the people will have substantial health insurance. The administration requires that the individuals, mainly workers, be insured with private insurance companies. I favor the Mills-Kennedy bill because I think it's likely to give medical service the most economically and the best package for the money as far as the people are concerned. Well, so much for issues here. And now my guest today is Jeff Anteville of the New York Daily News, a distinguished Washington reporter. Jeff, fire away.
Thank you, Senator. You mentioned a couple of the major reform proposals that will be pending in Congress, Senator. Do you think, in view of the amount of time that has already been consumed by impeachment proceedings in the House and that impeachment proceedings may very well consume in the Senate this year, that there's any real likelihood of major legislation in any area passing this year and being written into law?
Jeff, I think that depends upon whether we have a trial in the Senate. If the House impeachment proceedings end, let us say, along about the beginning of August, which looks like the timetable, which, frankly, and in my opinion, is 3 months too late, because I believed they should have acted by the middle of May. Then if there is no trial in the Senate, that is no impeachment, we will be able to pass effective legislation. I certainly would think that parts of this national institutions package I've just described can pass. On the other hand, if there is impeachment and the trial in the Senate, then you're absolutely right. It's very unlikely anything will go through except agreed upon conference reports of bills like the pension and welfare reform bill or appropriation bills.
On the subject of the impeachment investigation, Senator, I know you've been reading the transcripts. The White House has said that the transcripts which the White House has released exonerate the President from any culpability in the Watergate break-in itself or in the subsequent cover-up. Do you agree with this on the basis of your own reading?
I do not. I believe the transcripts are not decisive either way. They cast much light on the situation, but I do not believe that they, quote, exonerate, unquote, the President. all fulfill what our minority leader, I'm sure he doesn't like to be reminded about it, said some months ago that he's seen evidence that absolutely exculpates the president. I don't think they prove that. I will say this. I think the purple language which is involved and the general atmosphere of taking care of one's own skin, people in very high jobs, is really quite dismaying to the country, as it is to me. But I'm too much of a lawyer, and as former Attorney General of New York, naturally the language and the color are not going to convince me of guilt or innocence. It'll have to be the substantive facts, and there are a good many of those in the record, I might say. But I certainly do feel deeply depressed about the fact that in such a high place as the presidency of the United States, there should seem to be so callous an attitude toward the general public interest in many basic questions, and kind of an atmosphere of what can you get by with that'll save your own skin.
Senator, you mentioned the attitude in the White House, and you talked about purple language. There have been a number of reports that the president, in the course of some of these conversations, refers to several prominent officials, including yourself, using anti-Semitic, anti-Italian, and other anti-ethnic slurs. Do you feel that such references reflect on the fitness of Mr. Nixon to hold the high office he occupies, and do you feel that it's proper for the White House to excise or censor these portions out of the transcripts before they're made public?
Well, let me answer the last first, Jeff. I believe that the tapes should have been made available. I don't believe that what the president has done in the transcripts, especially that he is the one who's going to define what's relevant and material to the impeachment inquiry, that's what it really comes down to, that is a proper response to the subpoena. And I really feel that the House committee has the right to draw any implications that it feels proper from the fact that the original evidence, to wit, the tapes, were denied. As to the outrageously bad taste, to say the least, which may be shown by anti-Semitics or anti-Italian or anti-ethnic remarks such as you referred to, of course, we haven't seen those. Those have been excised. One can only be depressed and dismayed by any such even colloquialisms. Even if you tried to forgive it as well, just kind of bitching, as it to use a very colloquial word, it still is unforgivable.
In light of what you have learned about the Nixon administration and what it was doing in 1971 and 1972, in light of what you have subsequently learned, are you embarrassed in any way by your own active support for the president's re-election during the 72 campaign, including traveling around as one of the president's surrogates speaking for his re-election?
No. When you say embarrassed, certainly I wish I knew then what I know now. And if I knew then what I know now, I would, like the rest of the country, over 60% of which voted for Richard Nixon against McGovern, have had a very different attitude. But that's water over the dam. But under the state of facts which then existed, as far as we knew them, any of us, including me and all the people, I believe that we acted as we should have acted in the best interests of our country. So I have no regrets. I am embarrassed.
Senator, your junior colleague from New York, Senator Buckley, has publicly called on the president to resign, as of course you know. I've heard it said that you're taking a more cautious attitude on the subject of resignation, and indeed on the subject of whether the president should go to Moscow for a summit meeting in June, in part because you're running for re-election this year and you're concerned about alienating conservative Republican support in New York State. Is this a factor in your own position on the president's role and on the question of whether he should resign?
Well, Jeff, as to cutting and trimming, because this is my re-election year, I think it's, if you look at my voting record and my advocacy record, you'll find that I can't possibly escape doing things that are going to annoy and disturb conservative Republicans. Among them, the fact that the War Powers Resolution passed over the president's veto, roundly opposed and condemned by conservatives, including conservative Republicans, is mine. Secondly, my activities in the labor field, in the welfare field, in the anti-poverty field, I can't get home free on that. But I have a reason, and I don't want to compare it with my colleague, who has his own dynamics and his own reasons. My reason for not, quote, calling for the president's resignation, unquote, is the following. One, I believe it's sterile. Two, I believe it unprofessional. For me, I'm a very experienced lawyer. The president has said, I will not resign because I am innocent. Therefore, if I call on him to resign, that is, in my judgment, tantamount to a finding of guilty. Even with the purple language and my complete disgust with the transcripts, that's not a substantive proof, and that's what I must seek as a lawyer. And finally, I believe that the call for his resignation, at the same time feeling that, well, it's going to be a circus if he's tried, is not my dish. I'm not a bit afraid of a trial, nor do I believe the American people are. We've got to use the Constitution on occasion, whichever way it falls. And I believe it erodes the will of the Congress to use the Constitution by taking what I would consider the easy way out, to wit, calling for resignation, knowing full well that he isn't going to resign.
Senator, isn't it almost inevitable if the president does go to Moscow in June that there are going to be widespread charges from both directions, either that he was too soft or that he was too hard in negotiating with the Russians because of the impeachment threat?
There's no question about it, Jeff. You've put your finger on a very key point. My answer to that is the following. One, I believe that we must pass a resolution, and I intend to introduce one, which will make it impossible for the president to commit this country in Moscow to anything of consequence without the approval of the Congress. I think that's a good check and balance, and we've got to do it, so either secret or otherwise. And second, and very importantly, I believe you got to have a president of the United States. Now, the president could use the 25th Amendment to step aside. I hope he will do that. He should do that if he's impeached. Until that time, Richard Nixon is president. He must function as president. And in the trade-off of the fears that you express, which are entirely legitimate, and the need for pressing negotiation for the limitation of nuclear armament when that negotiation is timely, I choose the latter course in the highest interest of the country, even with all the troubles the president will be carrying on his back if, as, and when he goes to Moscow.
To shift gears very quickly, Senator, to the subject of the economy, you, I know, have been supporting the move to reimpose or at this point now to continue some form of wage and price controls despite the expiration of the present controls. In view of the fact that during the controls that were in force, inflation increased from around 4% a year to more than 14% a year, what makes you think that controls would work now and would have some effect on inflation?
Well, I believe that prices are really going to run away with all controls off. Therefore, machinery has to be available to the government to step back in. And as to the major bulge in already inflation already, I point out that the economy kept being decontrolled as we went along during that period, point one and point two. You might be at 25% inflation instead of 14 if there had been no restraints at all. Well, Jeff, our time's up. Thank you very much, Jeff Antiville of the New York Daily News, for being with me on a report to the people of the state of New York. And thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for listening to this report from Washington, from Senator Javits. Hello, everyone. This is Senator Jacob Javits with another report for the people of the state of New York from Washington. I'm going to change our format a bit for this broadcast. I have a very distinguished correspondent here whom we all respect greatly on Capitol Hill. And instead of making an opening statement on a number of issues, I'm going to turn it right over to him for questions, as I'm sure all the issues about which you'd like to hear will be brought out. I find it a great pleasure to be on this program with Bob Clark, the Capitol Hill correspondent for ABC. Bob, fire away.
Senator, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here with you. This has been a very busy week in Congress with important developments in several different areas that we want to get to. But I suspect the single issue that people are still most concerned with is inflation. The latest cost of living figures show a rather substantial easing of inflation in the past month. Does this ease your concern over what lies ahead?
Not at all. I think the price bulge, which is going on now in the area of 13% inflation, is still absolutely unacceptable and out of reach. I think the Congress has made a great mistake in dismantling all controls, not even standby controls, not even a monitoring agency, and I believe we're going to suffer for it very seriously. Now, the question is, for practical people, what do we do about it? Well, for one, I think we ought to allow the adjustment in the price of food, which seems to be going on, to go on. And we shouldn't have the United States government suddenly going into the market to raise the price of food at a time when it should be coming down. We've taken practically all controls off food production. So let's let this free market that's being so much bragged about have its play in respect to food. Secondly, I believe we have to pass the budget bill here in the Congress, which will for the first time give Congress some grip on the total outgo and the total inflow of governmental funds. And I think that's extremely desirable. Third, I believe that it's a great mistake to take the controls off fuel prices and to take the price regulation off fuel costs. And yet that's what's happening here in the Congress, in action just taken in the House of Representatives. I think that's an enormous mistake. Finally, and I shall do my utmost to correct it, and finally, and very importantly, the fundamental proposition of conservation in respect to fuel still continues urgent. It's a terrible mistake for the president not to be out there on the hustings asking the people to drive within the 50 or 55 mile an hour limit, save on electricity, etc. And the big issue, of course, in this country is productivity. And yet we're not mounting the drive to buck up productivity, which is the real way to answer inflation. So I'd sum up, Bob, by saying we haven't done very well. And we've lifted controls and even standby controls, I think, very prematurely before we were really ready for it. But we're in a pragmatic situation. That's the view of the majority of the Congress. And I've suggested the ways in which I feel we can repair the damage which we will have done.
Senator, you have been quite pessimistic about the overall state of the economy, warning of the danger of serious recession if inflation is not brought under control. What do you see ahead? Would you foresee a serious rise in unemployment, for example?
I do, and I'm still pessimistic because the measures have not yet been taken to get a grip on our situation. The Federal Reserve Board right now, quite rightfully, from its point of view, is engaged in a deflationary policy. And deflation is bound to produce some unemployment. The high cost of money, which tends to starve out businesses that need capital, is and aside from which taxes tremendously, the home buyer, etc., is inclined in the same direction. So I'm not very happy about it. And therefore, one, I'm very pleased that the administration has finally tried to ease up on housing finance, and I hope they will ease up more, and I'll do my best to bring him to do it. That's one way, one important way. There's been a lot of unemployment, for example, in the building trades. Secondly, I'm going to push for a bill which will give greater assurance of governmental jobs, if need be, to take up a serious unemployment crunch. Right now, we've got provisions for about 100,000. We probably have to get nearer 500,000 to really have to have it a real piece of insurance. And finally, we've got to continue the extra 26 weeks federal unemployment compensation. That runs out at the end of June, and I've brought it about before in short extensions, and I'm confident I can bring it about again. Now, those are some of the things I feel need to be done right away.
Do you share the concern, Senator Javits, of some people in the business and financial world, that the Federal Reserve Board is squeezing too hard at the moment, that it is more concerned about inflation than it should be, more concerned about recession, and it should not be squeezing so hard and pushing interest rates so high?
Well, the Federal Reserve Board, after all, has only one piece of the pie, and probably from what they have to do as the only agency that's really doing anything to try to deal with the inflationary runaway inflation right now, my guess is they're just about doing what they need to do. The difficulty is not so much with them as the fact that they're not balanced off by other forces, and I've named some of those in bringing down the cost of food and giving more public service jobs and taking care of a guarantee of unemployment compensation and feeding more money into the system in terms of housing, etc. So they may have to abandon what is probably a sound policy from their point of view simply because they stand practically alone.
There seem to be a growing number of people in the country, Senator Javits, who have the feeling, at least, that the president is being crippled in his ability to deal with inflation and other economic problems because of Watergate and the impeachment cloud. Is this hurting the president's ability to run the country?
Well, there's no question about the fact that he's a human being, Bob, just like you and I and every one other of the over 200 million Americans, and if his mind is obsessed with his own survival, he doesn't have the mind for creativity, which produced, for example, the new relationship with mainland China, which gave him the courage originally to install a wage price control system a few years ago, and so on. So certainly he's being distracted. But what can we do about it? We have decided as a country, and I think we're right, that we have to take the heat on this proposition, because the triumph of justice in respect of anybody, including the President of the United States, is more important to the moral health of this country than even the fact that the President is distracted and unable effectively to do his job.
Senator, there are a couple of other very important matters we want to discuss with you. One is that education bill that the Senate passed this week, and with some rather serious pangs in it for New York State. It is going to cost New York State quite a lot of money. It also contains an anti-busing restriction that is very confusing to most people. Would you begin by discussing the financial blow to New York State?
Well, the financial blow is attributable to the, and it certainly was over my dead body, shall we say, in the sense that I really fought it, and I was one of the managers of the bill, very hard. But the formula adopted is a formula biased in favor of sparsely settled and, generally speaking, rural states. Even in those states, they have cut off their noses despite their face, because their own metropolitan areas, and practically every state has them, there isn't one that doesn't really, are going to suffer from the formula that the Senate shoved down our throats. But nonetheless, that's what they've done. Now, on that formula, they've cost New York $30 million a year and educational support. New York, of course, still will get the major part, bigger than any state. New York will get about $211 million a year, even as compared with California, which will get somewhere in the area of $150 to $160 million a year under this new formula. And we still have to go to conference. We still have a fight on. In addition, I was able to restore some pieces which are good for us. For example, we could get as much as $10 or $12 million a year out of a section which deals with concentrations of poor children in given areas, that is, undue concentrations, like, for example, New York City, or probably Buffalo, a few other places in our state. In addition, another piece will give individual educational districts an opportunity to dip into a $35 million fund if under this new formula they've lost more than 10% of the allowance they had under the previous formula. Now, I must say, in explanation to my own people, Bob, that the previous formula, as it ultimately worked out, did give New York quite a bulge, but not remotely what they've taken away from us. But I think net, subject to the restorations that I've just described, which are small but taken together will amount to something, and the actual operation of the new formula when it's implemented with regulations, I think New York will have suffered a blow, but not a shattering blow. Now, as to busing, what's happened is that in a real stalemate, terrific fight to deal with the effort of a great many people here to cut off the busing tool as one way to bring about desegregation of public school systems in the hands of the courts, we've arrived at a stalemate in the sense that we've preserved it where it's necessary to enforce a decree, an order of the court, relating to unconstitutional segregation. So it must be it's strictly construed, but we have preserved. And in addition, we fought off an effort to reopen all court orders entered up to now and subject them to new standards. That was really the most damaging part of this effort of the anti-busing forces. So I would say we didn't win, but I would not say we lost either. It was a stalemate, but a fantastic struggle.
The battle on busing, of course, now shifts to a conference committee between the House and Senate. The House has passed a much tougher anti-busing provision, the Senate rather mild. What do you foresee? There has to be some compromise in that conference committee. Is Congress, in the bill that finally goes to the president's desk, going to do something that has the effect of restricting school busing?
I would say that it will have some restrictive effect, but it will not have a disabling effect. In the final analysis. What the terms will be, I can't tell you. We already have restrictive regulations in law respecting busing and a bill we adopted a few years ago. But I think this may add some amount to it. But my belief is that busing will remain, as it must, in order to comply with the Constitution, one of the tools, one of many tools, which the courts can use to enforce a decree against unconstitutional segregation of public school systems.
And Congress and the administration both got down this week to the serious job of fashioning some form of national health insurance. And the president made a radio address outlining his program. But in rather conciliatory tones, he indicated he would be willing to compromise with the other programs that are before Congress. You have supported the so-called Kennedy Mills bill, I believe. Would you explain your views, your reasons for opposing the president's bill, and your reasons for supporting this bill that is backed by two leading Democrats?
Well, thank you, Bob. I'm afraid this is going to be our last question, but I'd like to answer it in detail. I support the Kennedy Mills because I believe it has the most promise to bring the most satisfaction and the most modest cost to the people and to give them preventive health care, which is critically important. The essential difference between the Mills-Kennedy, or Kennedy-Mills, and the administration's bill is where the money is paid and who pays it and who is the financial provider. Under the administration's plan, the money will go from employers to insurance companies. Under Kennedy-Mills, the money will go from the beneficiary to the Social Security system. But all private means will be used, provided that they meet certain cost standards. I think that's more likely to use group practice units and health maintenance organizations and give the people a better break, both in quality and cost. I have some amendments to pipe into it, but right now I'm for the Kennedy Mills bill, and more than anything, I want a bill passed this year. Well, thank you very much, Bob Clark, Capitol Hill correspondent for ABC, for being with us on a report to the people of New York.